Good morning, council. Apologies. The next case on the en banc court's oral argument agenda is Flor Morency et al. Versus the State of Nevada Department of Education et al. Case number 81281. Are council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Mr. House, welcome, and you may begin on behalf of the appellants.
Thank you, Chief Justice Hardesty, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. Nevada requires that a bill that creates, generates, or increases any public revenue in any form to pass by a two-thirds supermajority of each legislative house. When Assembly Bill 458 was proposed, everybody understood that it was going to be a revenue-generating bill. The bill's sponsor repeatedly stated that it was intended to increase tax revenues. The bill was debated in the Revenue and Taxation Committees. And respondent Department of Taxation labeled the bill a revenue item and projected that it would increase revenues by millions of dollars in the current biennium and more in the future biennium. That makes this case easy. AB 458 increased tax revenues, just as everyone expected it would, so it should have received a two-thirds supermajority in the Nevada Senate, but it did not. Now in litigation, respondents deny that AB 458 increased any revenues, and even if it did, they argue that Article 4, Section 18.2 of the Nevada Constitution doesn't apply to bills like AB 458, notwithstanding the provision's plain language that it applies to increasing any public revenue in any form. Respondents' interpretation is not entitled to any deference because it openly conflicts with the Constitution's text, and for the same reasons, the district court's ruling should be reversed. I'll first say more about why AB 458 increased revenues, and then I'll explain why the supermajority requirement applies to tax credit repealed. AB 458 increased millions of dollars in tax revenues by repealing tax credits. Nevada businesses can receive a tax credit for donating to organizations that provide need-based scholarships to low-income families. AB 458 significantly curtailed the number of tax credits and scholarships available. In 2015, the legislature set the number of tax credits and scholarships available for fiscal year 2020 at 7.3 million. AB 458 reduced that to under 6.7 million. AB 458 thereby increased the tax liabilities of Nevada businesses by taking away available tax credits, and it canceled the scholarships of many Nevada families by removing funding for their scholarships. But as the bill sponsor testified, the tax credits were repealed and the scholarships were lost precisely in order to generate revenue for the state. The bill was debated in committees on revenue and taxation. The Department of Taxation reviewed the bill and marked it as a revenue item. And for those reasons, it can't be seriously doubted that the AB 458 was revenue increasing. However, respondents argue, and the district court held, that AB 458 did not raise revenue because it went into effect before July 1st of the 2020 fiscal year. Essentially, the district court held that because Nevada businesses could not apply for tax credits for 2020 until after July 1st, and the bill, AB 458, went into effect before July 1st, there were no tax credits to actually repeal. The court's holding, of course, implies that had AB 458 simply gone into effect after July 1st, then it would have been revenue raising. But there's no basis for that focus on July 1st. Article 4, Section 18.2 says that any bill that increases any form of revenue requires a supermajority. It's not limited to bills that only increase revenue in the immediate fiscal year in which they're passed. And precisely because Nevada's legislature only meets every 2 years, it is always passing bills or fiscal policies extending 1, 2, or more fiscal years into the future. There is nothing in the supermajority's provision or the supermajority provision's text or history to support the argument that a bill should be treated differently if it's passed on June 30th rather than if it were passed on July 1st. By repealing tax credits that would otherwise be in effect right now, AB 458 thereby raised revenues, just as Department of Taxation's
Mr. House, now, Mr. House, this is Justice Hardesty. I wanted to interrupt you, if I may, and go back to your first point. The state, not the legislature so much, but the state in its brief makes the point that AB 458 did not affect the revenue that was being generated by the MPR. The same revenue came to the state. The decision by the legislature to adopt tax credits is more of an appropriation or an expenditure activity, which would not be governed by the Constitution at all. Do you disagree with the fact that the same level of taxes would have come in on the revenue side? The focus of the constitutional provision is on revenue, not on expenses. So I'm curious if you could break that down. I appreciate your argument that by repealing the credits or rolling back some of the credits, that the general fund would have an increase, but I'm looking at the state's revenue as a whole, and it seems to me that if the revenue is unchanged, that the constitutional provision may not be implicated. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. That argument confuses expenditures with revenues, and this idea that the same amount of money is going to be going into the state from Nevada taxpayers is not correct, because if the tax credit exists, a Nevada taxpayer keeps that money. That's private money. It's not going into the public fisc. So just as the Supreme Court stated in the Wynn case cited in the briefs, the money that remains in a taxpayer's pocket does not belong to the government. And therefore, it can't be said that it's the same amount of money. It's just, on the one hand, private individuals or businesses can spend it, and on the other hand, the government spends it. No, it's different money.
Let me offer this hypothetical, and maybe this puts it in a slightly different context. Suppose that the scholarship opportunity program had been a direct appropriation by the legislature to these scholarships, or in fact, one of the appellants in this case, the AAA Scholarship Foundation, Inc. And then in 2019, instead of a bill in 458 that adjusted the credits, it just withdrew that appropriation. Would that have violated the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, because that's on the spending side of the ledger. But when it's on the revenue side of the ledger, when the government decreases the amount of revenue it gets by lowering your taxes and then raises your taxes later and increases its revenues, that's what requires the supermajority. And that's exactly what this case contemplated in the Gwynn case, when it kind of explained this provision, that budgeting and spending only takes a simple majority. But revenues are special. Revenues have this one-way ratchet where increasing revenues requires a supermajority. Now, the second argument that's made by respondents is that, well, even if this raises revenue, that this that the AB 458 isn't covered by the supermajority provision because it's a tax credit repeal, and those are categorically not covered. But that reasoning contradicts the text of Article 4, Section 18.2, which expressly covers any form of revenue increase. All state and federal courts to have considered the issue consider the repeal of a tax credit to be a form of revenue increase. And Article 4, Section 18.2 itself refers to, quote, any form. Therefore, Article 4, Section 18.2 applies to tax credit repeals because they are just one form of revenue increase. Now, respondents in the district court avoid this plain textual analysis by applying the test that Oklahoma and Oregon used for their supermajority provisions. The Oklahoma test says that in order to trigger the supermajority requirement, the proposed bill must not only increase revenue, but must also be like a new tax or have the essential features of a tax. But that test cannot apply in Nevada. Nevada's provision is not limited to new taxes. And in fact, the provision itself includes a non-exhaustive list of examples of revenues that are not new taxes and that are still covered, such as fees, assessments, rates, or changes in computation bases. And of course, it says it's not limited to these examples. Nevada's provision is therefore comparable only to the second part of that Oklahoma test. Only to the first part of the Oklahoma test. Does it increase revenue? the second part of the Oklahoma test doesn't matter because the Nevada Supreme Court expressly, or the Nevada Constitution expressly says any form of revenue increase is included. And again, every state, including the Oklahoma and Oregon Supreme Court.
Justice Kadish in Carson City, just so try to find the right box on your screen. The word increase only has meaning as a comparison of two things, right, to determine if it's an increase. So it seems to me the real question is when it says increase, what's it being compared to, right? Is it an increased revenue compared to what's happening now, or is it an increase compared to what would be happening under prior legislation? Like, so what do we have to tell us what, when they use the word increase, what things are being compared?
Well, at the very least, Your Honor, it has to be looking at what existing bills are and what the new bill that's being passed changes, because that's what the legislature does. When it's considering a new bill, it's looking at the direct effect of the bill it's considering. And AB 458 expressly strikes out the existing tax credit limits that were in place in the 2015 bill. So what's relevant here is considering the existing legal landscape. That's what the Department of Taxation was considering when it decided that this increases revenues. That's what the sponsor of this provision was doing, as he tried to convince his colleagues that this increases revenues. And even if you look at the Legislative Council Bureau's opinion, it called this a reduction in tax credits. So we're looking at reducing tax credits from what they were based on the previous regime.
Mr. House, and if you want to address, this is Justice Stiglitz, and if you want to address this in rebuttal, I am going to ask Mr. Powers, would you please address standing and why any of these individuals have standing on this claim?
I can address that very quickly. Your Honor, the district court found that all six plaintiffs have standing. It focused on Plaintiff Ibarra. Because after her family scholarships were reduced as a direct result of AB 458, and that's uncontroverted in the record, that she faced a $16,000 budget shortfall or shortfall for her children's private school, and that because of that, she actually had to work at the school. I think that's the clearest example of standing. And of course, as this court's well aware, only one plaintiff needs standing for this case to proceed. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Powers or Mr. Doobie, are you splitting your time or how are you proceeding?
Good morning, Chief Justice Hardesty. Our intention is to roughly split time, subject obviously to the questioning of the court of me proceeding first and then allowing Mr. Powers to proceed roughly equally, so 7.5 minutes each, ideally.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Newby.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Newby. I'm the Deputy Solicitor General for the State of Nevada, representing the executive defendants in this case. The 2019 legislature's decision to freeze rather than to increase Nevada Revised Statute 363B.119 subsection 4 tax credits for the Opportunity Scholarship Program did not require supermajority approval under Article 4, Section 18, subsection 2 of the Nevada Constitution. At the modified business tax, to which this is a tax credit for, remains the same at the same rate as at prior fiscal years. The subsection 4 tax credits remain the same on the same first-come, first-served basis as in prior fiscal years, and in fact, based on the 2019 legislature's actions in a separate bill, SB 551, there are more tax credits available for the Opportunity Scholarship for plaintiff parents to have their students apply for scholarships for plaintiff's private scholarship organization to distribute as they see fit, and for the private business plaintiffs to be able to seek tax credits for it. And in that context, where the same amount of public revenue is being expended for Nevada purposes here, with potentially at best a different distribution between tax credit expenditures and other appropriations made by the legislature, the supermajority provision simply doesn't apply. Additionally, I would like, to the extent the executive defendants focus a little more on standing, than my colleague at the legislature did, I would like to address some of those questions as well. We're in a situation where this is not a usual state-directed, state-implemented program. By its very nature, based on concerns similar to those associated with the educational savings accounts addressed by this court in Schwartz, on a larger level, this is a diffuse, indirect, privately organized system for opportunity scholarships. This is, instead of the state directing who receives scholarships and who receives tax credits, private scholarship organizations are inserted into that role as administrator and middleman for this program. Businesses wanting tax credits don't apply to the Department of Taxation. They apply to the private scholarship organizations. Students who want these private scholarships, they don't apply to the Department of Education. They apply to these private scholarship organizations. Private schools decide whether or not to accept these scholarships, decide whether or what tuition they choose to charge for these students, and choose which students, if any, they will admit. This is a very uncertain structure, which creates the situation where, under this court's precedent in terms of standing, in terms of Ellie versus Stevens, what harm when the total amount of tax credits available for opportunity scholarships actually increased? It was increased by the 2019 legislature. What harm, if any, can be fairly traced to the executive defendants in this case? It is not the executive defendants who decided that as a private scholarship organization that they could or couldn't award scholarships to certain students. It is not the executive defendants who decided whether or not private schools would continue to participate in the program or offer, or accept scholarships from these students. And it certainly is not the executive defendants' actions in this case that determine whether or not private businesses applied for the opportunity scholarship credits or whether they received them. It's just simply not there. In fact, it's a little unclear from the record that was provided to the court during the motion for summary judgment. There's points in the record, specifically Appendix 102 and Appendix 105, where the plaintiff businesses identify they received tax credits for the 2019 year, not suffering any harm whatsoever. And so there's two steps for there to be standing in this case. One is there must be harm. And those arguments have been addressed in the record, but they must be fairly traced to the actions of the executive defendants. And respectfully, the actions that plaintiffs' parents contend have harmed them are fairly traced to the private scholarship organization based on the structure of the statute and the program, not the Department of Taxation, not the Department of Education. Additionally, there is no need under the plain language of the supermajority provision in the Nevada Constitution to reach the question of whether it applies to tax credits or tax exemptions in the first instance. As noted in the record and as uncontroverted, the tax credits for subsection 4 remain the same, identical from year to year. They have not changed in any way, shape, or form. They just have not increased indefinitely into the future as plaintiffs would desire and would prefer as a policy outcome. But in terms of what the provision says...
Well, let me interrupt you, Mr. Newby. This is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas. You reference they're not increasing as plaintiffs desire. They're not increasing as the law required up until this law was passed, correct?
The indefinite 10% continual increase in subsection 4 credits was discontinued by the 2019 legislature. They were not yet operative, and the legislature decided to freeze them rather than to continue those increases.
You posit that question as the legislature making a decision whether to increase. It was really the legislature making the decision to vacate a law that allowed those tax credits to increase, correct?
Well, the legislature passed Assembly Bill 458, which had the effect of freezing future subsection 4 tax credits rather than having them continually increase at 10% increments per year. Yes.
Thank you.
But Mr. Newby, I want to go back to an argument in your brief, and I asked Mr. House about this, and to me it's an important question in this case. The modified business tax as a revenue source to the state did not change as a result of AB 458, did it?
It did not, Your Honor. It did not change at all. And so within the plain language,
turning to my hypothetical, here we are dealing with a system of tax credits that makes available the scholarship fund. But let's take this hypothetical. Suppose that when this program was commenced and back in 2015, the legislature had appropriated $6.7 million to AAA or other scholarship funds to be able to allocate to students around the state. And then in 2019, it had either repealed all or part of that bill. Would that action have been governed by the Constitution?
Your Honor, that's the elimination of an appropriation. I'm not certain. I mean, all is equal if the money was not. I think that's a difficult question to answer. I think it goes to somewhat to a question Justice Kadish asked of my colleague during prior argument, is what is that measured against? Is the elimination of an appropriation, does that constitute a revenue increase relative to something else, or is that a provision that it's eliminated, but the money is redirected to another program, which I think is probably more akin to what the legislature decided here, where public revenue remains the same, but the mix between how it's directed to public expenditure through the Opportunity Scholarship Program versus other measures is changed.
Well, let me posit it this way. The legislature appropriates money to the Nevada Department of Corrections. It appropriates money to the Department of Health and Human Services. If the legislature decides to change that allocation or even reduce the allocation, it conceivably increases the amount in the general fund, but it doesn't seem like that changes the total revenue available to the state.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that assessment of that hypothetical. It doesn't change the amount of public revenue at issue. It just changes the distribution of it. And with that, I've gone a little over on my time as intended. Unless there are any additional questions, I would defer to my colleague, Mr. Powers.
Okay, Mr. Powers, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal, on behalf of the Nevada Legislature. To start with your question, Justice Hardesty, a change in appropriation does not require a two-thirds vote under the Nevada Constitution. Appropriations do not come within that constitutional provision. In addition, in here, with AB 458, it is a revenue-neutral measure. The amount of tax credits available on July 1st, 2018 was $6.655 million. After the bill passed on July 1st, 2019, the amount of available tax credits was $6.655 million. The legislation froze the tax credits. In response to Justice Herndon's question, the provision in the law that allowed for the 10% annual increase at the beginning of each fiscal year was not legally operative yet with regard to the fiscal year beginning on July 1st, 2019. A bill can become a law but not be legally operative until a later date. Under the Nevada Constitution, any fiscal effect on the state, whether it's expending revenues or allowing tax credits for any particular fiscal year, cannot become effective until July 1st at the beginning of the fiscal year. It is not legally operative until that July 1st date. That's how the Nevada Constitution sets up the state governmental budget. There's a biennial budget during each regular session, and that biennial budget begins on July 1st after the session. So in answer to Justice Kadis's question, how, in this case, do we judge whether there's an increase? We look at the tax credits in effect on July 1st, 2018, the prior fiscal year, which was $6.655 million, and we compare it to what happens on July 1st, 2019 of the next fiscal year. In this case, the legislature froze it at the exact same amount. This is a revenue-neutral measure, and revenue-neutral measures are not subject to the two-thirds requirement.
So, Mr. Powers, sorry, Justice Kadish again in Carson City. So just, you know, playing devil's advocate, right? So the legislature put a fiscal note on the bill. How do you reconcile that with it being revenue-neutral?
Fiscal notes are hypothetical projections about what may occur in the future if the legislature does or does not take particular legislative action. That is based on determining exactly what could possibly happen. But in this case, what ultimately happened is the legislature froze those tax credits. And so the revenue stream is flat. It remains the same. The exact the same amount of revenue is being brought in as was being brought in before because those tax credits did not change.
Well, Mr. Powers, this is Justice Herndon again. Didn't Speaker Frierson specifically refer to this bill as being designed to generate more revenue into the general fund? I think his exact words were money that we give to opportunity scholarships depletes the general fund. Said another way, money that we direct away from that increases revenue to the general fund. So how can you refer to this as a non-revenue generating bill?
Justice Herndon, if you look at the legislative history, the speaker also said that AB 458 provides that the amount of subsection 4 credits is $6.655 million, which it is currently. This does not get rid of the opportunity scholarship program, said the speaker. This bill is designed to not allow that 10% increase in the future.
So, well, if a business loses its tax credits, they pay more taxes, which generates income to the general fund, correct? Let's set aside this bill, just that idea.
Okay, setting aside this bill, which was a freeze and revenue neutral, but we then turn, I believe, to the case law from the other jurisdictions that dealt with supermajority provisions and the repeal or reduction of tax credits. In the case law, both in Oklahoma and Oregon, those courts made clear that their constitutional supermajority requirements did not contemplate that a reduction in tax credits or tax exemptions increased revenue because the underlying computation base for the tax didn't change. The taxable subject, you know, the property being taxed or the transaction being taxed, times the rate of the tax is your computation base. That stays the same. Tax exemptions are applied after you achieve the computation base, and if you take away the tax exemptions, the revenue stream is not changed, and therefore it doesn't fall within the two-thirds requirement. Thank you, Your Honors. I'm out of time, I see, and I certainly am open to any other questions. Thank you.
Are there any other questions by justices to Mr. Powers or to Mr. Newby?
Yes, Chief, I have one. This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas.
Great. Go ahead, Justice. Why don't we do this? I'll add whatever time this matter exchange requires to Mr. House's time when he gets to the rebuttal. Go ahead, Justice Pickering. Sorry for the interruption.
No, thank you very much for the additional time. Mr. Powers, your model gives me a bit of pause, and I'd like to understand how you would respond to this hypothetical. Say we have a new tax that's generated due to the pandemic, and it is going to impose a 10% tax on everyone, but it will sunset in 4 years. And on that basis of the sunset and the needs generated by the pandemic, the legislature passes that tax on a two-thirds majority. Then, 2 years out, they decide they want to remove the sunset and continue it. Under your logic, that would not increase revenue because that sunset was not yet operative, although it was effective in the bill when the bill was passed. And I'm troubled by your argument that on effective and operative against the hypothetical I just offered, and I'd like your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you know from the LCB opinion, we addressed that question as well as the tax credit question. And our view is, once again, if you look at that hypothetical, the legislature imposes a 10% tax by a two-thirds vote and has a sunset 4 years later. But before that sunset becomes operative, the legislature changes the law so that sunset doesn't occur 4 years later. Maybe it extends it to 6 years. Maybe it removes the sunset. But the revenue stream remains the same. At the time the legislature passes that bill, it's a 10% tax. And that revenue stream after the legislature passes a bill is still a 10% tax. All taxpayers' burden remains the same. Because that sunset never became legally operative, then there was no entitlement for any of those taxpayers to that decrease in tax because that fiscal year point never reached. And the reason for that is, under the Nevada Constitution, we are on a fiscal year budget, and no expenditure or increase in revenue can occur until that beginning of that fiscal year. So looking at the simple flat line, 10% remains the same from the beginning of the tax through the first sunset until the next sunset, or if the sunset's removed and until after that, it's a flat line 10%. The taxpayer burden remains the same. Thank you, Your Honor.
And so on that, you would say then only a simple majority is required to freeze the sunset or to extend the duration of the initial four-year tax. Is that right?
That is correct. That is the opinion of LCB Legal, and that is the opinion that we gave the legislature during the 2019 legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. In the absence of other questions, Mr. House, we'll proceed with your rebuttal argument, and you will have 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Harvesty. First, just a very quick correction to the legislature's counsel, where he says that the Oklahoma and Oregon cases say that tax credit repeals or tax exemption repeals do not increase revenue. That's actually the opposite of what they say. Both Oregon and Oklahoma Supreme Court, and I can quote right here from the Oklahoma Supreme Court, it says, it isn't seriously in doubt that repealing tax exemptions increase state revenue. And in fact, it follows it up. It says, why does the government seek to close these loopholes in its tax code? To collect more tax revenue, of course. And the Oregon Supreme Court has very similar language. Again, every single...
So, Mr. House, I understand your argument there, and we've all read these cases, but I want to return to the facts here. I'm unclear as to how tax credits that are afforded to support a program increase the general revenue when the general revenue is effectively provided by the MBT, and it's the same amount of money. Could you help me out there?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think there may be some sort of conflation between the terms revenue and fund. The fact is, if a general fund number goes up, that is revenue. And that's why what the Department of Taxation looked at this, they looked at this bill, they said that a reduction in available tax credits taken against the modified business tax is a revenue item. That's in the fiscal note. Mm-hmm. So again, everyone in the legislature thought that was the point of the bill. And in fact, when you look at other states, they look at the repeal of tax credits as one form of increasing revenue. And I'll also point out that, you know, the Nevada provision says any public revenue. So let's say, for example, the repeal of tax credits doesn't put more money into the general fund. It puts more money into some other fund. Either way, it says any public revenue, if any public revenue goes up in any form, then it requires a super majority. Now, turning to the standing question that was brought up, SB 458 is enforced by the executive defendants. If my client, AAA Scholarship Organization, tried to violate the terms and give out more scholarships than it's supposed to, or take in and apply for more tax credits than it's allowed under that cap, it would face retribution from the Department of Education and Department of Taxation. That's why the executive defendants are in this case. And again, there were no facts introduced because standing wasn't, this wasn't argued at summary judgment. There were no facts introduced to controvert where the record says that it was a direct result of AB 458, and this was in a letter given to the various families that I represent. It was a direct result of AB 458 that it made it statistically impossible to grant their families scholarships.
Mr. House, and I'm sorry, this is Justice Kadish, I don't understand how that can be true. If the same amount of credits were still going to be available on the first-come, first-served basis, I don't understand why less would be available to give to the Ibarra family. What am I missing factually?
Yes, Your Honor, and it is sort of complicated financially. When the scholarship organizations have to make a decision to give a scholarship, they actually, under Nevada law, have to be reasonably certain that they can continue funding that student in the long term, all the way until that student graduates from high school. So the long-term funding, which is what the growth in the tax credits was supposed to be doing, is necessary to account for rising education costs and other sorts of kind of unknowns in the long term.
So the problem is that private schools are going to keep increasing their tuition even though the state isn't increasing the tax credit.
Your Honor, the problem, I suppose, could be many things with education funding. For whatever reason, it's again the all these scholarship organizations said it was statistically impossible to continue funding their families at the current rate. And again, at the very least, my clients who are business plaintiffs in this case, again, can't apply for tax credits that don't yet exist. And even if there isn't traditional standing, the Schwartz v. Lopez public importance test is easy here because both the legislature and executive respondents conceded this is a case of statewide public importance that was on one of the first pages of each of their briefs in this case. So again, I think the district court was correct to decide that all six plaintiffs have standing. And finally, looking at the term that both respondents keep using, which is that this simply freezes existing tax credits. Now, this does seem to conflict with the Legislative Council Bureau's opinion, which said that AB 458 either reduced or eliminated existing tax credits. But putting terminology aside, it doesn't matter what you call it. The fact is that Nevada is getting more revenues from AB 458. Before AB 458, it was getting less revenues. After AB 458, it's getting more revenues. That was the bill's entire point. And in fact, neither respondent has suggested there was any other motive behind this bill other than to increase revenues for the state's general fund.
Sorry, this is Justice Kadish. So if before there was the 6.6 million, or I may have the numbers incorrect, of tax credits, and following this bill there was that same amount of tax credits, what was the increase in revenue?
The increase, Your Honor, is because we look at this as a bill-on-bill analysis, not a year-to-year. When you're calculating your taxes for fiscal year 2020, if they've been lowered by another bill, and then the legislature gets rid of that other bill and raises your taxes back up, your tax liabilities have gone up. They have not stayed the same. And that's why this bill increases revenue. And again, it's exactly why the Department of Taxation reviewed it, said this is going to increase our projected revenues.
Thank you.
And for all those reasons, Your Honor, this case is simple. There's no need to defer to the legislature's complicated arguments. If a bill increases tax revenues, as everyone here understood that AB 458 would, it needs a supermajority, full stop. But because AB 458 did not receive enough votes in the Senate, it is not constitutional and should be enjoined. And if there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Are there any questions, Justices, for Mr. House? All right, Mr. House, Mr. Newby, Mr. Powers, thank you for your briefing and your excellent arguments in this case. The matter will stand submitted and the court will be in recess.